Good morning, Colorado. You're listening to the Daily Sun Up with a Colorado Sun. It's Friday, June 9th. Today, Sun writer and Sun Lit editor Kevin Simpson introduces us to a Colorado author whose latest book recounts how one man's life in the military segued into a profound influence on the state's sporting landscape. Before we start, a quick message. Join the Colorado Sun this September for the first Sunfest this fall. Topics will include policy and politics, the environment and outdoors, healthcare, and much more. Grab your tickets today. Visit coloradosun.com/sunfest. Now, let's go back in time with some Colorado history. On this day in 1864, the Cashlapooter River, already swollen with mountain snowmelt, overflowed its banks after a summer rainstorm. The flood in Larimer County took no lives, but it destroyed a small military installation known as Camp Collins. In the summer of 1864, Coloradans feared the prospect of American Indians attacking across the northern plains into their territory. To provide a measure of defense for the mining regions and protect travelers on the Cherokee Trail, the U.S. Army authorized a military base on the Cashlapooter River. Colonel William Collins, operating from Fort Laramie on the North Platte River, authorized the post, and the soldiers who established it named it Camp Collins in his honor. Weeks after troops set up tents along the river, it swept away their camp. Soldiers built a new post in October 1864, which was soon promoted to Fort Collins. The post was abandoned in 1887, but in the 1870s it served as the nucleus of a colony that took the name Fort Collins, a city best known today as the home of craft breweries and Colorado State University. Before we continue, join Jason Blevins on June 29th as he hosts Hit the Trail, Tips to Stay Safe While Tackling 14ers. The event is free and virtual. Register today at coloradosun.com/14ersafety. That's 14ER safety. Next, our feature story.
Happy Friday, Colorado. We're happy to have with us today Flint Whitlock, a Colorado author who has written extensively on military history and whose latest book, Life is a Game, with the late Joe Gunnell, also explores a chapter of Colorado's sports history as well. And it's also a Colorado Book Award finalist. Welcome, Flint.
Hi, Kevin. Great to be here.
So Life is a Game was a collaboration planned many years ago, but tell us about your friendship with Joe Gunnell and how this project took root.
I became a soccer nut in college when I was attending the University of Illinois, and I went into the ROTC program, and I wanted to get a regular Army commission so I could get my first assignment, which was 3 years in West Germany back in the mid-60s. And I thought, well, that would be fun to be in a culture where soccer is the primary sport, and maybe I could play on some, you know, local German teams or what have you. And that worked out. And then my last year was an assignment to Fort Carson. And so I ended up in the Springs for about four and a half years. After I got out of the Army, I got involved in the Colorado Springs soccer program, which was the kids program at that time was known as SOXI. And I formed a men's team. There was at that time, a small men's league playing in the Springs. I think there were probably about eight teams at that time. And through my efforts of playing, coaching, promoting soccer, I came to know Joe Gunnell. And Joe was living in Littleton, a Denver suburb. And when I finally moved up to Denver in 1974 to become the public relations director of the Denver Dynamos, which was the first professional soccer team in Colorado, I got to know him on a greater and more personal level. And so we formed a friendship, I want to say probably in 1974, and it continued on until he passed away in 2013. What I didn't know, because it wasn't on my radar at that time, was his background in World War II. He had been born in Germany, so obviously he was fluent in the German language, and he became an interrogator of German prisoners of war. And he did that while the war was going on for about the last year of the war. And then after the war was over, he was involved in interrogating high-ranking German generals and political figures in the Third Reich, and as a way of getting prepared for the Nuremberg war crimes trials in 1945. I didn't know this until I became a military historian in the mid-early 1980s. And he and I would continue to have lunch, usually on about a monthly basis. And several years went by, and he told me a lot of stories about his time in the service, as well as his role in basically starting soccer in Colorado back in the early 60s. So I had all of these little interconnections going on with him. And as he was getting on in years, he asked me if I would help him write his autobiography. And I said, sure, I'd love to do that. So we began collaborating on that. And he would, on our monthly meetings, he would bring me boxes of things that he had written over the years. He had started an autobiography, wasn't able to finish it. But he was also a very skilled photographer and artist. And when he was in World War II, in Germany, he did a lot of sketching and painting. And so he gave me copies of this artwork and his photographs, which became incredibly useful in putting together his life story. So what I've tried to do is to stay true to his vision and his words. There were a few things, like he might have written three versions of the same event at three different times, and they were all slightly different. So it was kind of on my shoulders to figure out which was the most accurate version. And of course, he was gone by that time. So I had to, you know, kind of take it upon myself to make whatever corrections were necessary, but always trying to keep it in his voice.
So this obviously combined two things. You're very interested in military history on the one hand, and soccer as a personal love as well. So how did you decide the mix of this book? Some of it would be military history, and you wanted to segue to the soccer at some point as well.
Well, I kind of let him take the lead on that, because his unfinished autobiography was a combination of both things: his love of the game as a kid growing up in Germany, and then moving to the States when he was a teenager, and then his interest in developing the sport in America. He was also, as it turned out, a really good baseball player in high school, but soccer was his first love. And when he was in the advanced Army training program at the University of Missouri, he put together a team of Americans who had never played the game before. There's kind of an amusing chapter in the book about his adventures in that particular realm, and how he took it upon himself to schedule a game with the top high school team in St. Louis. And how that game turned out. I think it ended up as a 1-1 tie, but he was very afraid that his team that had never played the game before would be totally embarrassed, but very proud that they did as well as they did. And then he went into the Army and overseas and didn't have a chance to play until the war was over, when he organized a few other teams. And then when he came back to the States after, I think, 1947, he began starting soccer teams wherever he went, and he became the first soccer coach for the University of Indiana, or I should say Indiana University. And they have been the most successful NCAA soccer program since those early days. They won more NCAA soccer championships than any other college.
Well, hey, having grown up in St. Louis, I can attest that as the United States goes, St. Louis was something of a hotbed of soccer going way back. So I could understand his fear that they might get shown up, but they didn't. But tell us a little about, you refer to him, I think, as the Johnny Appleseed of soccer. Tell us about how he sort of planted those seeds in Colorado.
In 1961, Joe had received his PhD in paleobotany, which is a very odd field. And he was hired by Marathon Oil in Littleton to go out into the Colorado wilderness and look for places where prehistoric jungles and forests once existed millions of years ago, because those would be the places most likely to have oil deposits. And so that was his profession. When he came to Colorado in 61, he discovered that there really wasn't any organized program for kids to play soccer. It wasn't being played in the high schools, and there were no junior soccer leagues or anything. So he and another fellow, a Dutchman in Littleton, started the first organized kids program. And it expanded over the years, and he, I think, worked very tirelessly to get soccer into the schools and the high schools. And he did everything. I mean, from lining the fields and putting up the goal nets to washing uniforms to writing press releases about, you know, the activities that were going on. So he really devoted all of his spare time to promoting the game. And then as his fame grew, he began going to other states and helping them start soccer programs as well. And he was inducted into the Colorado Sports Hall of Fame, the first soccer guy to be in Colorado Sports Hall of Fame. And then in the 1980s, he was inducted into the U.S. National Soccer Hall of Fame as a way of recognizing everything that he had done to promote the sport.
Wow. Well, so I believe you said he passed away in 2013. Is that right? So at that point, later in his life, I mean, certainly the youth programs, high school programs in Colorado had taken leaps and bounds. What did he think of his work?
I think he was tremendously proud of what he had accomplished here. I think he was not one to toot his own horn. He much preferred to work behind the scenes to get other people excited about soccer and to keep the sport rolling and get more and more kids involved in it. He was, I would say, a humble yet proud person. He knew what he had accomplished, and I think he was very happy with how things turned out here while he was still alive.
Well, I'd like to turn a little bit to the literary side of this and putting this book together. As an author of military history, what is it about the subject? And certainly Joe had this, in his own story, that draws you in as a writer.
I think I became interested in military history as a young boy back in the Chicago area. I had a really good friend. He and I were both military oriented. We collected toy soldiers, hundreds and thousands of them over our lifespan. And my friend went on to become a professional military historian at the U.S. Army Military History Institute in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. And my dad had been in the 10th Mountain Division, which of course has a very strong Colorado connection. And back in the late 80s, I began working on finding out more about the division. He died when he was only 57, so he never really had a chance to tell me much about his experiences in the war. But I always knew that World War II was very important to him, the whole world for that matter. And so I wrote an article. It was my first published article in a World War II magazine. And I thought that's kind of cool. And then I had a 10th Mountain veteran contact me and tell me that he had over 200 photos of the 10th And he read my article and asked if I would like to collaborate on a history book about the 10th. And I said, yeah, that would be fabulous. And so we did. And I thought, well, maybe it'd take about 6 months to flesh out the article. 6 years later, I'm still working. I'm interviewing 10th Mountain veterans every time I could find one. And he would usually tell me about two or three or six other guys I should interview. So this just almost spiraled out of control. The name of that book was Soldiers on Skis. And that really got me started as a full-time author and military historian. I've done battlefield tours of Europe for various organizations. I lecture on World War II, on Viking cruises. I lecture all over the state on various topics related to World War II. And in 2019, I became the first military historian to be inducted into the Colorado Authors Hall of Fame. And it was all kind of on a fluke. I never set out to be a writer or a military historian, but that's the way it worked out.
So with regard to this latest book, would we look for it under military history or sports? How would you classify it?
Or maybe biography. You know, that's a good question. Yeah, that's hard. It's hard to know because the cover here shows Joe in his Army uniform, and I think this is probably taken in early 1945. And the subhead is Life is a Game, Adventures of a World War II Interrogator and U.S. Soccer Pioneer. So it's both a sports book and a military history book, as well as a biography / autobiography.
Well, we've been talking with Flint Whitlock, who collaborated with Joe Gunnell on the Colorado Book Award finalist, Life is a Game. Good luck. It's this weekend, I guess we'll find out the winners, but it's certainly an honor to be a finalist in this group.
Well,
thanks for joining us, Flint.
Thank you, Kevin. Take care.
You can read more at coloradosun.com. Finally, here are a few stories that you should know about today. The cause of the 2021 Marshall Fire in Boulder County is now public after a nearly 18-month investigation into the wildfire that killed two people. The Boulder County Sheriff said Thursday that fire was started by embers reigniting from a controlled fire that were buried for 6 days on a residential property, as well as sparks from an unmoored Xcel Energy power line. Wind gusts on December 30th were more than 100 miles per hour, which fanned the flames and burned 1,000 homes. The district attorney said there was nothing criminal about the acts and no charges are being filed. Colorado cities and counties will be prohibited from imposing population and residential growth limits under a bill signed into law this week by Governor Jared Polis. It will also repeal existing growth caps enacted in Lakewood, Boulder, and Golden when it takes effect in August. The law aims to address housing shortages by stripping local governments' ability to limit how much new housing can be added to their communities. Local governments across the state strongly opposed the bill, calling it an overreach by the state and complaining that it would prevent communities from deciding how to address their unique needs. The debut of the Big Gear Show in downtown Denver this weekend is the first step in a grand plan to establish a one-of-a-kind outdoor festival in Colorado. Boulder's Outside Inc. and Visit Denver last month asked for a $50,000 state grant to kickstart planning for what Connor Hall at the Colorado Outdoor Recreation Office hopes could be an outdoor-centric South by Southwest-type festival. The combined Big Gear Show and Electric Bike Showcase in the Colorado Convention Center is the test of that concept, with 100 exhibitors in what is being billed as the first business-to-business-to-consumer trade show. For more information on all of these stories, visit our website, coloradosun.com. And don't forget to tune in again next time. Before we go, we encourage you to check out a new podcast from our friends at KUNC called The Colorado Dream. Here's a sneak peek.
The new season of The Colorado Dream explores the Black immigrant experience in Aurora. It's told through the eyes of one African woman.
I would sit on the beach and just daydream about coming to America.
And the city of Aurora that's working to become an inclusive home for all.
In the last 20 years, we have a new face of the city.
I'm Stephanie Daniel. Join me for the Colorado Dream Newcomers Welcome. You can find the series at KUNC.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, a quick message from our editor.
I'm Larry Rickman, editor and co-founder of the Colorado Sun. The Sun is a public benefit corporation, and we rely on the support of listeners and readers like you to produce the nonpartisan, in-depth news that Colorado needs and deserves. Please consider becoming a Sun member for just $5 a month. Learn more at coloradosun.com. Thanks.